This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Honoring heroes, talking about heroes. It's something that's always been a passion of mine. Look, I'm a dude. When I was a little bitty boy, I wanted to read books about heroes and war heroes. And like any human being, I wanted to watch movies about heroes. I look up to people who have these incredible acts of bravery on their resume. This is something we admire. We watch movies about Captain America, right? They don't even have to be real heroes. But the truth in life is usually they're fictional or we don't know about them. Think about this. Think about any war hero you can name. Somebody who's done something amazing in combat, World War II, Vietnam, whatever it may be. Most of them died or have passed on since then. You don't get to actually talk to them. You don't get to actually open up their book where they write down what they did and they just lay it out for you. Delta Force. I had a sergeant major when I was in the United States Marines. I was just an average Marine, but just an average grunt Marine, but he was one of these super stud types. And he had served with all kinds of other branches and things. And he'll tell you to this day, I still text him. To this day, he'll tell you Delta Force are the baddest dudes on the planet. But we never hear from these guys. They're so quiet, we never hear from these guys. What if there was someone who was EOD in Vietnam, and then after Vietnam, he went on to found one of the founding members of Delta Force? You know, the guys who just went into Caracas and snatched the president. How do you make men like that? Why would you even do something so dangerous? Sergeant Major Mike Vining is internet famous, I'll put it that way, because he looks so unassuming. Look at those badges and medals. The man has done some things, including Delta Force, and he is going to join us next and talk to us about his life. I'm about to nerd out. You ready? I'm proud of where I give my money. Mobile companies are garbage in general. Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile are horrible companies, and I've had all three of those companies. I've funded all the garbage filth they fund, but now I'm proud to tell people I'm a Pure Talk customer. Pure Talk, they're so pro-America that when you get a hold of someone at Pure Talk, they're American. They understand you. They're pleasant and helpful on the phone. If you need any assistance at all switching over, they'll just sit there and patiently help you do it. That's the difference of Pure Talk. That's what happens when you have a Vietnam veteran lead your company rather than one of these freaks at the other companies. Switch, you'll pay less, and you'll be proud to pay your cell phone bill. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. When I was a young, very average Marine, keep in mind, just 4 years, my sergeant major had done some work with some of the really bad dudes you watch movies about. And my sergeant major, United States Marine, keep in mind, will tell you to this day that Delta Force is the best on the planet. He didn't say best in America, he said best on the planet. But I'm unbelievably unqualified to opine on such things and Vietnam and other things, but you know who most definitely is? The legend himself, Sergeant Major Mike Vining, founding member of Delta Force. I can't wait to get to that. Calls himself a demo man, Bronze Star recipient, and of course his book, as we said, Blasting Through, is coming out. So Sergeant Major, I guess before we get to Delta and everything else, but before we even get necessarily to Vietnam, you're growing up in Michigan, you end up blowing things up in Vietnam. How's that happen?
Well, I grew up, you know, my high school years, junior high school years, it was the 1960s, you know, Vietnam was going, you know, 1965, we put combat troops into Vietnam. In my senior year of high school, the Tet Offense occurred. And so, it, of course, it was on the nightly news all the time. And so I'd always wanted to go into the military, but I wanted to serve my country. And I wanted to go to Vietnam to see what's it all about. You know, what are we doing there? Why are we there? And are we making any progress? You know, you get the, you know, the White House and Department of Defense, the Pentagon would tell you one thing. The, you know, Walter Cronkite and the nightly news would tell you something a little bit different. Probably no different today. But I wanted to find for myself firsthand.
Well, Sergeant Major, there's a bunch of ways you can find out what's going on in Vietnam, even in the 60s. You could have even been a journalist. You didn't have to put on a uniform and go get shot at. What's this drive to join the military? What was it? Did you just want to better yourself? What was it?
Well, you know, I'm a baby boomer. You know, my dad served in the Navy during World War II. He was on an LST. I had an uncle that served in the Army. He was on Guadalcanal. I had another uncle that served in Korea. You know, I had family that served, you know, in the country. If you go back to the Revolutionary War, I had family that fought in Revolutionary War, War of 1812, the Civil War. My grandfather on my mother's dad was a Marine prior to World War I and served in the Pacific on the armored cruiser USS Maryland in the Pacific before World War I. So I just got a family history.
You get to Vietnam, you got the uniform on. What are you doing? What hit you? What shocked you?
Well, what shocked me in Vietnam? You know, in the countryside, the rural countryside, to me, they were just doing subsistence living. You know, they were farm using their water buffaloes and, you know, cultivating rice. To them, they didn't, what was going on in the South Vietnamese government, what was going on, for the most part, they just wanted to make a living. And, you know, so life didn't really matter to them, the politics. They were just, I could see that. And, but I liked my job as explosive ordnance disposal because, you know, we clear the danger, you know, we get rid of the hazardous devices, the explosives, and we try to make it safe, not only for the military, but for the civilian population. And it's a very, I think, very noble cause. I enjoyed EOD work. You know, I always said that we're probably a glorified garbage collector, but it's, you know, the ordinance of the world that didn't go off.
Sergeant Major, can you actually drill down on that? Because for 99.9% of us, when we think about, you know, EOD, something like that, you of course picture a scene in the movies where you have to cut the red wire and not the green wire. But obviously real life is quite a bit different. For most people, that's a little nerve-wracking to walk up to any kind of an explosive device, if it's a mine, whatever, and have to remove it, have to disable it. What is that like?
Well, I wanted to know myself that question. You know, I saw a movie, and it was World War II, and this was when I was in high school. There was this black and white movie about the Battle for Britain. Germany was bombing London and the countryside, and a British officer, there was a German bomb that penetrated in London and went down into the catacombs, a large German bomb. This was in the movie, and a British officer alone walked up in the catacombs and disarmed that huge bomb. And I was just amazed, you know, a person that would be able to do that. And I was wondering, you know, what does it take to do that? And so I found out. It's interesting.
Do your hands get shaky? I mean, you're standing over something, and obviously you could become a pink mist in any moment. Are you one of these people who's just, you know, brain surgeon type, just naturally smooth and calm, or is your heart pounding through your chest?
It's relaxed. You know, the training is really intensive. And I remember my first big bomb, you know, and it was a Mark 82. There was actually two of them. They dropped them into this is during the Cambodian incursion, and there was this clearing, and 1st Cav wanted to occupy this clearing for a fire support base, so they did it, called in an airstrike, and then they did a combat assault, and they started setting up the 105s, and then they noticed what they thought was three bombs inside of the fire support base that didn't go off. So we were called in, and as we flew in, we were met by the assistant division commander of 1st Cav, came up to our helicopter, shook our hands, said we were the most important people here, and had a colonel lead us to where the bombs were. Now, one of the bombs had gone down deep and detonated really deep, and it formed a crater we call camouflage. It didn't break the surface, but that cavity is pretty dangerous. It's possible that somebody could walk over the cavity, the ground could collapse, they could fall into that bomb cavity, and of course the noxious gases, carbon monoxide, you know, they could kill them before somebody could get them out. So there was a camouflage. And then the two bombs, one was kind of laying horizontal on the ground. The other one had gone in and came up and the nose was sticking out. So we dug that one out. And so the bombs had nose fuses. They were M904 impact nose fuses, were sheared off on impact. So there's nothing to worry about on those fuses because all the important stuff is outside the bomb. And once it was sheared off, we didn't have to worry about it. But they had tail fuses, and they were the M905 fuses. And the windows, you have a little window there. You can see that the window's red, and that means the bomb is fully armed. And so the E7 took one bomb, I took the other. We both simultaneously removed the fuses from the bomb. So this is my 500-pound bomb, 250 pounds of steel, 250 pounds of explosives. And each turn, I turned the fuse out by hand. And I was just wondering, you know, if this thing goes off, you know, will I actually see the bomb casing swell? Would I actually see what would happen? That was going through my mind, you know. But I got the fuse safely out. He got his fuse safely out. We walked into the jungle, set up charges, blew the fuses. They came in with a helicopter and they sling loaded the bombs out.
Are there moments like that where maybe it flashes at least through your head, man, I could be working in a factory in Michigan. What am I doing here?
I did work in a factory in Michigan.
I know.
After I got out from Vietnam, I got out of the Army for 2.5 years. So I got a job there in Greenville, Michigan at they stamped out body parts for Ford. It was a contract company. And so in a short time, I became the lead man on the largest press in the shop, a 500-ton press. And at sometimes we'd have four presses operating to form these forms, body parts for automobiles. And so that's what I was doing. It's pretty good pay in Michigan, but I just couldn't see spending 20, 30 years or what doing that job. You know, in a short time, I became the lead man on the press. And actually, that press work was really dangerous. I had a chunk of dye came off and hit me in the cheek. It felt like I got hit with a baseball bat and cut my cheek, and a piece of metal was inside. They had to go in my mouth to get the metal out. You know, pretty much I came unscathed in Vietnam working in a factory. We had one guy who was operating a press. He lost his whole arm, and I put a tourniquet on his arm. He got caught in the press. Factory work is dangerous, but I just couldn't see spending. So in October 73, I rejoined the Army.
We will come back to that. Let's take a little sidetrack, Sergeant Major. No judgment here, of course. Are you an adrenaline junkie? All young men, or at least men, have some of that in them, a sense of, again, maybe in a sense of adventure would be a better way to put it. But is that you?
Yeah, I like that climbing was my drug of choice. Rock climbing, mountaineering, caving. I started climbing when I was 16. I was still in high school. I went out to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Exum Mountaineering School. They offered mountaineering courses. So at 16, I took mountaineering courses. So for an escape, you know, on weekends, you know, I would take off and go climbing in the military. And a lot of times TDY would take my climbing gear with me. So I became a professional member of the American Mountain Guides Association, American Alpine Club, the Missouri Speleological Survey, the National Speleological Society. So those were organizations. So I did caving, climbing, mountaineering, and I just enjoyed it, because when you're climbing, you forget about anything else. You don't think about work, just looking at what's going on, and you got to be attuned to what you're doing. So yeah, when I went to Delta, the unit psychologist did an evaluation on me, and because I did rock climbing, mountain climbing, caving, I had a motorcycle, I had a Kawasaki 750, which was one of the fastest street legal bikes that were produced. So I had a Kawasaki 750, and I'm EOD, and now I joined Delta. So he thought I had a death wish. And I told him, I says, no, that's wrong. I have a lifeless wish. You know, I just wanted to experience and live life and not be afraid. You know, I never feared death. You know, death happens. So but I was surprised, you know, that I never expected to be. Today I'm 75 years old. I didn't, that surprises me.
How about that? All right, let's rewind before we get to Delta and selection and all that. What's Rock Island East? Most people have never heard of the place.
Yeah. Rock Island East was the largest enemy weapons and ammunition cache that was discovered in the Vietnam War. And so in May of June, President Nixon, May of June 1970, President Nixon authorized U.S. troops officially to go into Cambodia. And this was part of the Vietnamization program. We were turning in 1970, we wanted to get out of Vietnam. We wanted to turn the war over to the South Vietnamese. So we wanted to give the South Vietnamese a head start. So for 2 months, we entered the sanctuary zones of Cambodia, where the North Vietnamese had stockpiles of ammunition. They had their command center. They had hospitals, schools, R&R, motor pool, weapons, stockpiles of weapons and ammunition. So First Cav, a pink team, and First Cav helicopter actually saw the caches through the jungle as he was flying over. And First Cav, Second of the 12th, Charlie Company. They seized the Rock Island East, and then they called in EOD. So, yeah, and then I was one of the seven EOD folks at Rock Island East, and these were in the jungle. They were different cache sites. There was a trail, and these different cache sites along this trail, a lot of weapons and ammunition, 328 tons of weapons and ammunition. I think that's what the figure was. And everything from from 122 rocket launchers to all the weapons. And they even had what surprised us. They had a stockpile of 85 millimeter fixed ammunition there. Well, there's only two weapons that I know of that will fire 85 mil, the Soviet Chaikom 85 millimeter fixed ammunition. It is they have a field gun that will fire it. I think it's called the D-44. And they have the T-34 tank that will fire those rounds. Now, we hadn't seen any of those field guns. We haven't seen any of the tanks in South Vietnam, but they were stockpiling ammunition for that. So they were getting ready for some kind of an offense. And we blew all that stuff up. Now, we only blew up, I think it was 72 tons. All the weapons were backhauled out. And the 12.7 ammunition was all backed out, carried out. They hauled that out. It took us 6 days to set it up. We used 288 cases of C4. We wanted more. We asked for 340, only got 288. We used, I forget how many cases of detonating cord, but we set that shot up. And so on the ground, when we blew up Rock Island East, as you see in that photograph, there was only two EOD guys on the ground at this time. It was me and Master Sergeant Land. And then we had a small squad from Echo Recon, 2nd of the 12th for security. And so we got ready to pull the shot. Now we had dual detonating cord lines going to all the cache sites, and we buried them so that the enemy came in, they would have to find the detonating cord leads because we concealed them. And so we had 10 priming systems that of 10 minutes, and any one of the 10 priming systems could set the whole thing off, because we wanted to make, normally you dual prime. We primed with 10 priming systems because we weren't coming back to this one. And so we lit the fuse. There was two helicopters on the ground. Master Sergeant Land and I jump in the lead helicopter. And I got ahead of myself. As we ran to that helicopter the first time, this captain, infantry captain on the radio, yells at us, says, "Cut the fuse, cut the fuse, cut the fuse," three times. So we run back. We don't know what's going on. So we run back. We cut the fuses. We run back to the helicopter. And then he yells at us to light the fuses. But we used up all of our fuse igniters, our M60 fuse igniters. So we had to go back out there. Now we have short fuses. We're splitting with a knife, splitting the fuse ends. We're putting a match head in, and then with C-ration matches, and lighting it. And if you're quick, you can light two off one. And we lit the things back. But while we were lighting that, our scare charges, we had eight scare charges that around the HLC, time to go off starting at 2 minutes, had 2 minute time fuses. Now the scare charges was to keep the enemy, at bay while we evacuated. We didn't want them to come in and, cut the fuses. So, and our scare charges start going off, but the people on the helicopter, they don't know nothing about our scare charges. And I think they thought we were getting mortared. and they were ready to take off. But so anyway, we light the fuses, we jump into the helicopter. Helicopter can't lift off the ground. It's overloaded. So door gunner taps me on the shoulder, says, you're gonna have to get off. Tapped another infantry guy, says, you gotta get off. And so the two, and we had to go and get the helicopter in the back. So we get off the helicopter and we look, and that's helicopter in the rear, same problem. It drops off two people. And now these helicopters are taking off and there's four of us on the ground. So I'm going to go and cut fuses because I don't want to be here when this thing goes off. And another helicopter that was in orbit, I don't know where he came from, came down, picked us up, and we got out of there. And I took that photograph that you were showing with my camera. And you can't really see it too good, but in the background, there's a mountain called Nui Ba Ra. And that's 50 miles away. And at Song Bay, and they could see our mushroom cloud 50 miles away.
Good grief.
That's Rock Island East.
Okay, again, I want to remind everybody that Blasting Through is the name of the book if you want to get so much more of this stuff. All right, pause on that. I guess that's time out. Time out on that. We're going to be right back with more. Hang on. We are losing 1% of our testosterone a year. We have lost, as you can imagine, 50% in 50 years. Our T levels are gone. There's a reason you see a men's clinic on every corner of your town now. Men know it. They're out of energy. Their brains aren't working well. They're not who they're supposed to be. So do you think you should go get a needle jammed in your arm, or do you think you should maybe try some natural herbal supplements first? You know, go try Chalk. Chalk will have you turned around and feeling like $1 million naturally, and they'll have it quickly. You're 90 days, probably 60 days, 90 days away, 20% increase in your T levels naturally. Go to chalk.com/JesseTV. Get a subscription. 90 days away. We'll be back. Okay, Sergeant Major, so maybe in the oddest part of this whole story is you get out of Vietnam, you already mentioned you're working in a factory, and you end up with Delta Force. What? Is Delta Force shoulder-tapping people who are working in factories across the country at the time? How does this happen?
Well, I went back into the op, and Delta was not formed up until November of 1977. So I went back into the Army in October of 73. When I went back into the Army, they weren't taking, in 73, they weren't taking many prior services back in. So the Army recruiter told me I had to go back in as EOD, and I said, that's great. So he says, how about going to Fort Leonard Wood? And I said, yeah, Fort Leonard Wood is fine. So I was at Fort Leonard Wood from 73 to 78. Now, there was in 76 on a Secret Service VIP support. We support Secret Service. We do all the bomb. The EOD does all the bomb searches for the military for the Secret Service. So in 76, we were in Quincy, Illinois. There was a series of domestic bombing IEDs at this factory. And we were there. Senator Dole, who's running as Ford's vice president, and his wife Elizabeth were there speaking in Quincy, Illinois, when these bombs were going off. And anyway, they left the next morning. There's a bomb threat called in on the airport where they were at. We had done the searches, and they discovered it at the factory. One of the bombs didn't go off, the IED, and so anyway. Long story short, Sergeant Major, he just made Sergeant Major, Ken Foster, was going down for a recon on an IED, and it blew up, and he was killed. Wow. I was the first person to him. He was killed immediately. There was nothing I could do to save his life. So anyway, after that, I decided I needed medical training, more medical training, you know. There was no nothing you I he was right there in the vicinity of the explosive device that when it went off. But I went through an EMT, became an EMT on the side. I was registered in Missouri, nationally registered EMT. So I decided I wanted to leave EOD and I wanted to go in special forces. I wanted to be a special forces medic. Well, and this was in 78, and I had a school date in 78 to be a special forces medic. But then I got a phone call. My sergeant major, control sergeant major, called me up and says, "Hey, Mike, they're forming a new unit up at Fort Bragg. They're looking for six EOD NCOs, preferably if they have combat experience, to join this new organization." He gave me a telephone number. So I called that telephone number, talked to a person on the line. He says, "Can you come in 2 days for an interview?" And I said, "Sure." So I flew to Fort Bragg. I saw the Command Sergeant Major Country Grimes there, saw Colonel Beckwith, and did all my interviews. And then within 10 days, I PCS'd to Fort Leonard Wood and started. It was the beginning of Delta, and they were forming up the first operator training course. Now, I didn't go through selection and assessment. I hadn't at this time, but it was impressed on me that at some point I have to complete selection assessment. But there was five EOD NCOs in the first course, and I was one of them, OTC one, and we went through there. There it is. You can see I'm the guy bottom left with glasses. Next to me is the other EOD tech, Irvin Banta, and we. So there was so an OTC. One, there was five EOD techs. OTC two, there was five EOD techs. Only in my OTC one, only two of us made it through. OTC two, only two EOD people made it through. And then we went through selection assessment, and only three of us made it through. So we only had three EOD operators in Delta. And they wanted Beckwith, Colonel Beckwith wanted six. So how to get six? We couldn't get any more EOD people to pass through the selection course, and so we took three Special Forces demo guys. They were 12Bs, just before the 18 series, and we sent them to EOD school to make up our six, and they passed the EOD school. So that's how we got our first six.
Why weren't people making it through selection? It's not exactly surprising to anybody watching that Delta selection wouldn't exactly be a walk in the park, but what gets people? What got people back then? I'm sure it's changed somewhat by now.
When I went through selection assessment, it was in Yorey National Forest in North Carolina in the fall of 78. That was the last Yorey selection. Today, since then, all the selection courses are now in West Virginia. But it's basically the same. The whole premise of selection and assessment is that it's you are doing the whole thing by yourself. There is actually no harassment at all. You don't get any harassment from the cadre. You are told you start you are told you're so we use carrying weight and doing land navigation. You're not allowed to use any roads or trails, and you're given an RV and to go to. So you don't that day you don't know how many RV points you got to hit. You don't know how far you got to go that day, and it's all timed. So there's a cutoff time, and you just got to go as fast as you can. So we start out with you carrying 45 pounds in your pack, and that's not including any water or food that you're carrying. And of course they weigh your pack, make sure that it's within the weight limit. And then it goes up to 50 pounds, and then it goes up to 58. And also during the course, you are physically carrying a weapon in your hand the whole time. And then you've got a map, you're using map and compass in the other hand. And of course, the RV points, they are through the most rugged terrain that they can find. And it's all timed. And you just got to go. The only person that's motivating you is to go. So what they're looking for is somebody that can work alone and doesn't know the meaning of the word quit. They make it easy to quit. You know, there was one of the RV cadre that was at one RV. This was in North Carolina. It was North Carolina. He said to a group of people at the end of the day, he says, there's two trucks here. One truck's going back to Fort Bragg, and this truck here is going back to the base camp. And everybody at that RV that collected at that RV point at the end of the day got on the truck to go to Fort Bragg. Now, he thought he made a mistake and pointed out the wrong truck. He says, you guys, this truck's going back to Fort Bragg. And they all shook their heads, said, yep, they were done. They quit. No, you know, no harassment. They just, the whole group just quit. You know? So you work all by yourself through the selection and assessment. When you go through the operator training course, you work as a team. So what they're looking for is somebody that can work by themselves and then also can work within a group, a team. There are people that can, you know, just only function by themselves, don't work good in a group. And then there's people that only can work good in a group. So that's kind of the idea in selection and assessment, what they're looking for. And the whole time you're selection assessment and the operator, you're being constantly evaluated. And then even when you make it, you know, you're out, you're in the squadron, we have a saying that selection assessment is never over.
Tell me, you have all these operations, and actually I don't want you to have to go into all of them right now. I want people to buy Blasting Through and find out about all the things you did after you joined Delta. But these guys, and I mean, all I can do is talk to people like you. All I can do is read books. I was never that guy. Do you feel a sense of pride? For instance, recently we saw Delta very famously went downtown Caracas, snatched up their president and the first lady, and you were part of the founders that built that unit. What goes through your mind when you're watching TV or on social media and you find out, wow, they're still putting in work?
I'm just so proud of them, you know. I hope, you know, that we were able to, our lessons learned, you know, trial and error, things that we did and developed, you know, our tactics, techniques, procedures that we developed, you know, that helped them, and they benefited from all the our lessons learned, you know. I mean, I was impressed, you know, with, you know, what they did. I understand. I haven't just, this is based on the news. There, some of our guys were injured. But it was really successful. The air support was just tremendous. We never had that kind of air support. So that's great.
Sergeant Major, I don't know whether you knew, or I'm sure you know by now, but how you found out that you are internet famous, if you will. That this is something that anybody who spends any time online, they know about Sergeant Major Mike Vining. And it's the joke, for those who may not be aware, is look at this very normal looking guy. He could be doing your taxes, but he's probably the deadliest person you ever meet in your entire life. I'm really genuinely curious, when did you find out? How did you find out? Does it tickle you? Do you find it strange? Tell me about this.
Yeah, I do find it strange. I think what happened is, I think it was back in 2008. You know, there's a website called Together We Serve. Are you aware of the website? Together We Serve? Well, there's a Marine Navy, Air Force, Army, Coast Guard, together we serve. And you know, they're all interlinked. So I signed up the Army Together We Serve, and I put in my profile. You know, I put in that photo, and, you know, and all this kind of stuff into that website, Army Together We Serve. And I think people went on the website and they looked at me and was like, who's this person? I've never heard of this person. Look at what he's wearing. Is this a case of stolen valor? Some imposer? You know, nobody knew who I was. And so there was memes, but there was a few people that went on the site and knew me and said, yeah. But one of the things, they were looking at my badges and stuff like that, and they said, look at, see where the EOD badge, the Master EOD badge is down on my breast pocket, down in the left. This, well, today, that's a Category 2 badge. But back in my time, it was Category 5. So in 2002, they moved the EOD badge up, the Army did, to the 2, just below the Combat Infantry badge. And so it should, you know, but back when this photo was taken, the Airborne badge was the next badge in the order. I got out in 1999 before 2002. So that's why my uniform looks the way it is. Yeah, the EOD badge, I don't know why it was always in Category 5. It's a hard, it's one of the hardest academic schools in the military. Today, it's like a year-long process. The washout rate is really high. I mean, to get the airborne badge, all you have to do is jump out of an airplane 5 times. Now, the EOD badge, you've got to go through this intense school, and then you have to actually serve in order for it to be a permanent badge, you have to serve 18 months in an EOD unit, and then it becomes a permanent badge. None of the other badges require an 18-month thing. So I'm glad in 2002 they redid the badges.
His book is blasting through Sergeant Major Mike Vining. Sergeant Major, it's an honor for me, sir. I appreciate you very, very much. Thank you for everything, and Semper Fi to you. It's an honor, sir, seriously.
Well, thank you.
All right. Blasting Through is the name of the book. You want to look, we didn't even go into all his Delta Force operations. Iran and Grenada. Can you even imagine the stuff that's going to be in there? Blasting Through is going to be, that'll be a good read. All right, final thoughts. Next. Chips are everything, aren't they? Let's be honest. When you're snacking, pretzels are fine. A cracker, I love a cracker, but I'm a chip man. The problem is the chips that you buy in the grocery store and the gas station are awful. They're awful for you. I take that back. They taste fine. They're awful for you. And then you know this because after you get done eating them, how do you feel? You're sitting back and you're unbuckling your pants and you're thinking, oh, I don't feel good. What if you could wipe out an entire bag of potato chips guilt-free, the best chips you've ever had in your life, and you're not bloated and tired and wanting to just nap afterwards? That's Vandy Crisps. You didn't think you were stuck with unhealthy chips the rest of your life. Potatoes, salt, tallow, not seed oils. Go enjoy potato chips guilt-free. Wipe out the whole bag if you prefer. VandyCrisps.com, promo code JesseTV. Wasn't that freaking cool? We didn't even get into all the Delta Force operations. I didn't even think, look, we ran out of time. I didn't even think it was necessary, but isn't that freaking cool? There are guys like that who still exist today. You know that, right? Guys who are still in. Guys we never get to talk to. Guys we never get to hear from. So when we get a chance, I want to know what drives them. Why? Are you an adrenaline junkie? Why? Those people are awesome. I'm honored we had the chance. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. We'll do it again.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.